it certainly should be in these cases. If it's a case of medical treatment and lifestyles being severely affected, it should be on scientific rigorous scale saying, oh yes, this vaccine is the definite cause of this, we can prove it with this graph, this here. It should be a lenience, say, look, there is a probable cause here, there is a system set up to account for this, it should be used. Hello everyone, welcome to the Legal Nerds Podcast, the podcast for the modern nerd. We talk all things sciencey, nerdy, and a smidgen of skepticism. Yes, I said the podcast for modern nerd, as I always do. And joining me, as nearly always, is the Jim Carrey to my... what's her name? McCartney? Jenna McCartney.
You know, the internet is going to be talking, you know. There are already rumours, James, and you've just fanned those rumours. And once again, we've got the intro wrong. We never get it right.
I didn't say the intro was fine.
It's not. You've said podcast twice. You only say it once. I'm going to... You know what? Next time we do it, I'm going to get it right.
The podcast is called The League of Nerds Podcast.
It's not. The podcast is called The League of Nerds. You don't have to add it on. I don't... when I make a YouTube video, I don't go, hi, welcome to the Power M1985 YouTube video channel. You know, you don't, there's no need for it. Yeah.
So,
how are you doing, Mocker, anyway?
I am a bit crap, let's be honest. By the time this is meant to go live, I'm meant to be starting a new life in Des Unis, United States. But thanks to El Trumpo, my partner is currently banned from the US. So we'll see. Yeah. Maybe when this goes up live, things will have changed. But as of this week, it's kind of crappy.
I'm sorry to hear that, buddy.
Oh. Yeah, but that's not the topic. That's not our topic. We're joined, though, by Travis, who we've wanted to get on for quite a while. Travis is gonna talk to us today about vaccine courts and all that sort of fun stuff.
So, hello there, Travis.
Hi there, guys. Thanks very much for having me on. It's great to be on.
Oh, no, thanks for coming on. I've been looking forward to talking to you for some time, ever since James said...
It's been over a year that we've been trying to organize. Yeah, I remember, like...
So come on, Travis, pretend this is blind...
My fault, yes.
No, it's all right, Kay, it's all right.
I was going to say, so pretend this is blind date then. So who are you and where are you from and all that kind of jazz? Pretend that we're Cilla Black. That probably means nothing to you, sorry. But
well, I'm Travis. I'm from the United States. I was originally from Southern California, but I kind of traveled around and lived in a variety of places. And I'm an attorney. I'm licensed in California, but I work for the federal government right now, so I don't have clients. I'm not really doing attorney work at the moment. I'm just sort of involved in various policy issues and such. So yeah, I don't really have any connection as far as professionally to vaccines or the vaccine court or anything like that. It just was an area of interest for me.
Oh, cool. So what is this vaccine court then?
So the vaccine court is a special portion of the Court of Federal Claims, and it is a place where people can go who believe that they have been injured by a vaccine, they've suffered a vaccine injury, and they can file a petition in order to get some compensation to help them deal with that injury.
But I've seen Rob Schneider say that you can't get compensation. Why would Rob Schneider lie to me?
I don't know. He's got such an honest face. In fact, victims of that, people who have suffered legitimate vaccine injuries have received over $3 billion in payouts and in compensation in order to help them with their injuries.
And that's since 1986, I think, was when they founded the vaccine court. So it's a fairly substantial amount of money paid out. And this is one of those sort of weird catch-22s that anti-vax people say, oh, it's impossible to get money. But then in the next breath they'll say, and the government's paid out $3 billion. That just shows you how unsafe vaccines are.
Exactly. Yeah, and that $3 billion is spread out over around 5,000 cases or so that have been compensated. And I think, I believe that is since 1998. There was sort of a reconstruction of the program after it was founded. And so, yeah, a lot of the statistics that we're talking about today go back to 1998. And some of them go back to 2006 when the influenza vaccine was added to the list of vaccines that the program will cover. And just because there's just so many doses of that vaccine given out on a year-to-year basis, it just totally changed when we're talking about statistics. I mean, it's like a billion doses over since 2006.
From a medical standpoint, when you have something that there's a risk of genuine serious harm in 1 in 100,000, and you're giving it out to 100 million people, you're going to have a handful of people who have genuine medical concerns.
Absolutely, and I think it's just important. I think everybody who does any science advocacy in this area needs to acknowledge that, you know, a vaccine is a medical intervention, and like any medical intervention, there are some risks.
Well, I can't remember what the exact numbers are for aspirin, but there's a syndrome where if you take aspirin, it's life threatening, and I'd bet a sandwich on that more people are likely to have injuries from that than from vaccines, because vaccines have to go through this huge regulatory, you know, hurdles and stuff, whereas aspirin's kind of been grandfathered in from, you know, a long time ago. You're 100% correct. If you are a science communicator, it doesn't help anyone if you are quiet on the issue of actual risks.
Right. And one of the things is that, you know, as a lot of times tends to be the case with risks that are very, very rare, is that the complications can actually be pretty severe. And so you see that number, $3 billion paid out over about 5,000 people. You know, that's a lot of medical care that would have fallen on the families. So overall, it's been a really good way for families to get the help that they need.
And it's as schemes go. So maybe you could explain to us where does this money come from? Who's paying for the treatment and stuff?
So there is I think it's technically called an excise tax, but it's a small portion of the price of every vaccine that is taken, and it is given to part of a trust fund. And the trust fund is managed by the government, and any awards that are paid out of that, are paid out of that trust fund. The trust fund can also be used to pay for attorneys representing the litigants at the vaccine court. And it technically, I believe it's called the Vaccine Injury Program, as opposed to the vaccine court. But, you know, it's easy enough to say vaccine court. People who are involved in the program, their attorneys can be compensated from the fund, and some of their expenses, if they have to retain experts and such, can be compensated from the fund.
So I've got to ask, though, going way, way back to the beginning, when you say vaccine court, is that just like a cool nickname you've given this court, or is it actually something that is like different? I mean, can you just go out and sue a vaccine manufacturer in America?
So that's actually more of a complicated question. We'll get into a little bit of that later, I think. But by and large, the Vaccine Injury Program covers certain vaccines. And they're the ones that are listed as being recommended for children, and there are ones that are there's like a catch-all category that says if it's not listed on this table of vaccines that we cover, but it is still recommended for every kid, then it'll still be covered by the program. So it's a limited number of vaccines that are covered by the program. Like, for example, when I went traveling, I had to get a vaccine for, I don't know, Japanese encephalitis or something like that. And that would not have been a covered injury. So if I had suffered an injury from that vaccine, I would have been able to go and directly sue the manufacturer without going through the court. But if I had gotten one for, say, flu, which is covered, then I would first have to go to the vaccine injury program. And there I would have a hearing, and my case would be determined. And if I didn't like the outcome of that case, then I could go to the court, to the regular court, for a lawsuit, with one exception, which we're going to hit later.
Okay. I'll make a note of that.
Yes.
So we're, how did we get to a point where there's a separate judicial system for vaccines?
Well, you know, it started back in the late 70s and early 80s, and particularly with concerns that were that revolved around the DTP vaccine. There were a couple of cases where litigants had been successful in winning large verdicts against the vaccine manufacturer, and a lot of this related to a seizure disorder and what they called a residual seizure disorder, which essentially somebody has a seizure, whether it's induced by the fever or whatever, shortly after the vaccine, and then eventually develop either epilepsy or some sort of other seizure. And the argument was that all of that started with the vaccine. And so with these things that go on for the rest of a person's life, the awards were fairly large in the court. And it actually had a significant effect on the market. And when, lawyers, as soon as we hear that somebody's had a successful case, we want to get our own case. Mm-hmm. So to give you a sense of what happened, from 1978 to 1981, there were 9 lawsuits total regarding this DTP vaccine. By the mid-80s, there were more than 200 a year. And just that huge explosion increased liability, and it really destabilized the market. The companies that manufactured DTP were estimating that their potential liability was like 200 times annual sales or something like that. It was just a huge liability. So 2 of the 3 producers of DTP actually left the market, and the one that was remaining eventually suffered from production problems. It wasn't able to keep up with the demand, and so that's when the government decided to get involved and set up this alternative. And it was a group effort between various stakeholders.
But why though? I mean, what's mm-hmm. the problem with people like suing vaccine manufacturers if there's so many of them? I mean, what's the worst that can happen? Why would the government need to step in?
Well, it's not necessarily a have-to situation, right? I mean, it's a decision that was made on a policy basis that it would be better to not have to deal with all of the court problems and all of that, and the risks of having, incorrect verdicts and the costs that are associated with that, and instead to have an alternative court set up where their families would be able to get compensation, but would not have to go through. The manufacturing companies would not have to have the expense of litigating or the incentives to drag out litigation to avoid, making payments.
But I don't get it. So why isn't there a court for pacemaker manufacturers or I don't know, cochlear implants? Why is vaccine courts their own thing?
Well, it's sort of an accident of history, and I believe it has to do with a lot of the fact that this is something that is just so, there are so many doses of vaccines given out that maybe we could afford it if every person with a a pacemaker or an implant filed a lawsuit, and some of those would be dismissed and some of them would be successful, and a lot of them, would land somewhere along the way with them being partially successful. Maybe we could afford that as a society, but with vaccines, it's just so huge because there's so many people to get these, this intervention, that I think a lot of it had to do with that. And there were extensive discussions over years about how to go about implementing this program. So I think that has part to do with it. But I should also say that this is an experiment in what, in law we call tort reform, which is the idea of, not having every injury be litigated in a traditional civil court. Especially in medical, there's a lot of interest in having alternative courts, maybe with experts acting as the decision makers, as opposed to the jury, a regular jury. So it's an experiment in tort reform. It definitely is, and there are people who are advocating for, especially with medical and heavily regulated industries, to have those decisions being made not in regular courts. Yeah. It's an ongoing debate.
right. I thought as well it was semi-based on the idea that, well, these vaccine manufacturers were getting sued left, right, and center in America, and they were being like, well, why the hell should we make it over here then? And then that would be a public health problem. Have I got that right, or is that completely wrong?
No, yeah, absolutely. From the vaccine manufacturer's perspective, that's definitely what they wanted. They wanted a limited, you know, they wanted lower liability. And so from their perspective, that was one of the reasons why they wanted to go along with the program. Absolutely. Absolutely. The point I was trying to make was that it wasn't just that a lot of times you hear, you know, the vaccine industry, you know, held the U.S. government hostage and said they weren't going to produce any vaccines. If, you know, you get that kind of rhetoric. And to be honest, that's just not the case. This was a decision that involved lots of stakeholders and a lot of thought out, you know, a lot of discussions and a well thought out process.
It does, though, when you hear it first, it does kind of feed into like a vaccine conspiracy, though. There's a special cult for them because they know the truth, and the truth is these things are bloody evil.
Absolutely.
Or is that just me?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's got a lot of, it's similar to, you know, a lot of what goes on with the vaccine argument is that there's a lot of pathos to the argument when you have an injured child, and it looks like they have the whole system against them. You know, that's a pretty powerful emotional argument. Mm. But there are benefits to the injured parties to going to the vaccine court as opposed to going to a regular court. One of the biggest one is that the vaccine court, I keep saying vaccine court again, it's a vaccine injury program, is a no-fault program. And what that means is that if you go to a regular court, you have to demonstrate that somebody made a mistake somewhere along the way. You don't necessarily have to show who or whether it was that did it specifically or where it happened, but you have to generally show that somebody made a mistake. And usually that has to do either in the manufacturing process or mm-hmm. in the warnings that are provided. And with the vaccine court, you don't have to do any of that. You don't have to show that anyone made any mistakes. All you have to show is that your injury was actually caused by the vaccine, and you get compensated.
What kind of injuries are we talking about then?
There is what's called a vaccine injury table, and it basically lists on one side all of the vaccines that are covered by the program, mm-hmm. and then it lists injuries that are known to be associated. So,
is autism on there?
Autism is not on there, no.
You'd have to say that though, wouldn't you?
Yeah, right, yes. No, autism is not on there. Which is why some people in their cases, they tend to try to rebrand autism as, for example, encephalopathy, which is a table injury for several vaccines, because it is something that can happen. It's rare, and the results of when it shows up are almost, it's not within months, it's within hours. But it is a possible complication. So you hear people or see people writing online say, you know, that autism and encephalopathy are the same thing, which of course is ludicrous.
It's not true.
Not true at all.
It's just, yeah. So they're completely different.
Exactly.
If encephalopathy was autism, diagnostics, treatment, everything else would be completely different. It's yeah.
I'm not medical minded. I don't know what encephalopathy blah 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 is.
It's the swelling of a lining of the brain, I believe. It's like meningitis. Meningitis is the inflammation of the meninges, which is the coating around the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Encephalopathy is the similar swelling.
All right.
I'm just going to double check I've got that right now.
Just get that up. Make sure you're right. Sorry, I know. So, is there any, like, because I know whenever I've looked on my videos that I've covered the whole vaccine subject, a lot of people do hint to these courts, and they do say that a lot of people have been successful, and that proves that these vaccines are harmful for everyone. What do you say to that?
Well, first of all, a couple of things. First of all, the standard of proof that that people have to reach when they're going to the vaccine injury program is what we call a preponderance of the evidence. And essentially, it means that a little bit more, if it's slightly more likely than not. that this injury was caused by this vaccine. Now, obviously, that falls well short of what you would need if you were going to, say, publish a scientific paper. But that's because we're not dealing with science here. We're dealing with law. And what the judge, they're not called judges, excuse me, they're called special masters who are over the, who you know, preside over the and make the decisions in the vaccine injury program. What they're doing is weighing evidence. They're not, by and large, experts themselves. I think one of the current sitting special masters has a degree in nursing or something like that. But by and large, they're not scientists and they're not experts. But what they are good at is they are good at weighing evidence. And so that's their role. So even if, for example, you were able to go and prove to a special master that this vaccine caused this autism and it wasn't related to anything else on the table, no encephalopathy, none of the other stuff, that would not, that wouldn't really say much to the scientific community. It might say something to the legal community, but it wouldn't necessarily have anything to say to the scientific community as to whether or not that was true.
So I was wrong about
you it. Can't get it right now.
No, it's too late. It's not just a swelling, it's any dysfunction of the brain can be classed as within this, but again, autism isn't the same sort of thing. It's not a physical difference that you're looking
right.
for.
Right, and one of the things that we'll get back to later, I'm sure, is that as long as we're talking about autism as a collection of symptoms, it's really a different thing than what we're talking about when we're talking about a physically measurable, you know, dysfunction in the body. Yeah. Obviously, the goal in autism research is to link those symptoms to some identifiable, you know, dysfunction. But at the moment, that hasn't happened.
So I'm assuming that the big vaccine manufacturers get to choose who the special masters are. Just yeah.
No, actually, the special masters that are on the vaccine program, they are appointed to their post for a 4-year term by judges of the Court of Federal Claims, which is the court that people go to when they want to sue the United States government for money. And the judges on the Court of Federal Claims, in turn, are appointed by the president and confirmed by Congress. So this I mean, it's not to say that there's not necessarily lobbying going on, but no, these are judges that are just chosen for their legal skills.
Yeah. Now with vaccine-friendly Trump on board, it's
oh yeah,
like another 4 years of yeah. It one of the things that Trump might have a conflict of interest is his pro-business and anti-vaccine. I don't know which of those lobby groups would win out.
Yeah.
We'll see. It true that he had Andrew Wakefield at his
inauguration? Yeah.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
That wouldn't surprise me. I know that he did meet with what's his name? Is it JFK Jr. or something?
Robert Kennedy Jr.
Yeah, one of the leaders of the movement. Yeah, I know.
Oh. Less about him, the better. So if you can prove that you have a symptom on this list of possible causes, possible diseases from vaccines, that's the preponderance of evidence. That should be enough to show that you got the symptom from a vaccine.
Yeah, if you have to be able to show that you got the vaccine, first of all, the vaccine that's on the table, and that you suffered the complication that's listed on the table, and that you did so in the time that's required. And there's an additional requirement that your injury has to be a serious injury. And what there's a definition for that. I can't remember exactly what it is, but it's something to do with either involved, the symptoms lasted for longer than 6 months, or it involved hospitalization and surgical intervention. In order to be covered by this program, and again, if you're not covered by this program, that means that you can go directly to sue the manufacturer or to sue the doctor if that was where the error happened. But again, to be covered by this particular program, the injury has to be a serious one. And if you meet all of those requirements, causation is presumed. Unless the other side, the respondent in these cases is the Department of Health and Human Services, if they can show that it's more likely than not that something else happened, like they can show, for example, that you suffered another infection that was the actual cause of your injury, But the burden's on them to demonstrate that. Otherwise, causation's presumed and you're going to get compensated.
Yeah. So for the several people who claim that, you know, this is the way to stop people, because autism obviously isn't on the list from the MMR vaccine or any of the thimerosal-containing flu vaccines, this is used as evidence that, oh, this is government cover-up, that you can't sue them. The item's on the list, but you're saying if that's the case, you can just sue them normally.
You can, if you're talking about a vaccine that's on the list. If you're talking about an injury that's not on the list, then you still have to go through the compensation program. But you can allege that you suffered a vaccine injury that's not covered on the list, or that you suffered a list injury, they call it a table injury, but it happened outside the time requirement. In that case, you can still prevail, but causation isn't assumed. You have to demonstrate causation by a preponderance of the evidence.
So perhaps, I know you wanted to talk about, there's quite a, is it the autism omnibus?
Yes, yeah, so around in the late 90s and early 2000s, you know, not coincidentally, around the time of the, you know, the Wakefield paper and a lot of the publicity around, you know, thimerosal and all of that, there were a lot of people, I think it was around 5,000 cases, that filed in the vaccine injury program for compensation, arguing that their autism had been caused by a vaccine. And with so many cases, and it's just such a huge volume, all dealing with pretty much the same issue, there was a meeting between the attorneys and the families representing the autism-injured people and the Department of Health and Human Services and the Office of Special Masters, and they decided that they were going to process these by way of an omnibus proceeding. And basically what that is, is there's two different ways that it's been done. This was not the first omnibus proceeding done in the vaccine injury program. They can do it one of two ways. One is they have what they call a general causation hearing, where basically usually what they'll do is they'll take leading attorneys that are representing some of the petitioners, and they will have them represent the interests of everyone, and they'll conduct a hearing on the general issue of whether this particular vaccine caused a particular injury. And then they'll basically take the results of that hearing and make those available for use in all of the individual cases. It's a sort of a way to sort of streamline the evidence process. The other way that they do that is they do it with what they call a test case. And what they'll do is they'll take a test case and have that case be litigated. Sometimes that'll be combined with a general causation hearing, but then the results of the test case and the evidence of that will be available to the other people that are involved, the other petitioners.
So it's similar to, I forget what the term is, where you have like a mass action. I forgot what the term is, the mass action lawsuits where they have...
A class action.
Class,
In the United States, it's called class. It may be called something different.
Law's not my strong suit.
Yeah. It's very similar. The one difference is that in a class action case, all of the petitioners' cases would be resolved in one decision. In a test case, each case is still resolved on its own merits. And after the test case is done, all of the people have the opportunity to present additional causation evidence if the test case didn't go their way. So that's the one big difference. There's no.
I mean, that sounds beneficial to the plaintiff, as it were. The right word? The person filing the complaint?
They're in the vaccine court. They're called petitioners, but it's the same. Yeah. They play the same role. This was actually proposed by the petitioner's attorneys. So this wasn't something. A lot of times you'll hear, you know, they forced everybody into this omnibus proceeding. That wasn't the case. Anyone could have opted out at any time. If they decided to stay in, then nothing would be moved on until the test cases were resolved. Yeah. But no, nobody was forced into it. Anybody could have opted out of it. There were a handful of people who left, although nobody asked to present their own case. And it was just because there was such attention being paid, and basically you had attorneys that were working on your behalf, even though you weren't necessarily paying them.
Mm. So why do you think this is such a cornerstone of the anti-vaccine movement then? Why do you think people keep bringing it up if it's meant to, well, do what you say it does?
Well, the are we talking about the omnibus proceeding or about the sort of the court generally?
Well, generally, yeah,
Oh, yeah, generally, I think it's because there's a lot of, well, there was in the you know, late 70s and 80s, is that there's a lot of good press, maybe we should say, that can be garnered from having large jury verdicts against a vaccine manufacturer, even if those verdicts aren't necessarily supported by the best science. And I think that this process sort of, it definitely reduced the number of people who were willing to go to try in those verdicts, because, like I was saying, a lot of them, if they were able to show causation, they didn't have to have the extra burden of proving that somebody had made a mistake along the way. And so if you lost in the vaccine court, it's very unlikely you're going to win in a civil court. And I think not having that resource, which is something that in the United States anyway, it's one of the ways that people try to affect social and policy change is through strategic lawsuits. And I think this does reduce the ability to do that. And so I think that's one of the reasons, you know, being generous here, I think that's one of the reasons. You know, if you were being a little more cynical, we could say, well, you know, they want to win large verdicts based on sympathy for someone who is undoubtedly an injured child. The question is just, did the vaccine cause the injury?
Hmm. As, actually, James, a quick question on the side. Is there anything like this in the UK?
There actually is.
I don't know.
There is.
Okay.
There is. Well, there is a, in the UK, there is a compensation program. It's not similar to this, but you can, without going to court and without having to show that anybody made a mistake or anything, you can apply for aid, essentially. It's a little bit, but it's set up a little bit differently, and I don't think that there's the same necessarily prohibitions on lawsuits, but products liability in the UK is different from products liability in the United States. And so I think that was one of the reasons why the idea was to go to a separate court in the United States. You may not have that problem in the UK.
Oh, right. Oh, cool. That's really interesting. So one of the things you wanted to bring up was a special court case. What was it called again?
Part of the omnibus proceeding there, obviously, actually, do you mind if I talk just a little bit more about the autism proceeding?
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off before,
no,
by the
not
way.
At all.
I did it on purpose.
Not at all. No problem. I just wanted to give everybody sort of the scope of what went into this case. These are cases, some of them were filed, you know, as early as the late 90s. And the last test case that was resolved wasn't resolved until 2010. So this was a very long amount of time. And it involved meetings between the Office of Special Masters and the petitioner's attorneys to set up how they were going to do it. The way that they ultimately decided to do it was to have the petitioners essentially advanced three theories of causation for how the vaccine caused autism. One was that the MMR vaccine by itself caused autism. That was largely based on Andrew Wakefield's idea that, you know, portions of the live measles virus remained and migrated their way to the brain. The second was that thimerosal-containing vaccines on their own could cause autism, and the theory there was essentially that that the mercury,
it was thimerosal that can be broken down into ethyl mercury inside the body.
Right. Yeah, and that
hey, chemistry.
There you go, chemistry. And that could make its way to the brain, and then that could cause.
By the way, did you see when I said that James just like started like shaking his head, just like no, it's not the one pure science. We've already talked about the hierarchy, James.
Your hierarchy is completely wrong.
It's not. It's maths, physics, chemistry, biology. The tops can go down.
All you do is twiddle tubes and make pretty colours, where I try and understand the fundamentals of life.
Right. Hang on.
All my work is chemistry when it comes down to it.
Mm-hmm.
You're just on the bottom of the steps, like, chipping away at stuff when I'm right at the top. Whatever, looking down again. What the hell are you doing down there? There's important stuff up here.
We are the true makers. You're just the monkeys we give stuff to.
Oh.
Ooh, take that, James.
Shots fired.
Anyway, sorry, I've interrupted you again. I don't mean to.
No problem. And then the third idea was that a combination of MMR and thimerosal containing vaccines could cause autism. Eventually, that got whittled down to two. Because the evidence for the first and the third theories essentially was all the same. So eventually that whittled down to two, and then they assigned three test cases for each theory. And each of those test cases was decided by a different special master. And there was extensive discovery. There was lots and lots of testimony and pages filed into the record and all of that. I wanted to give it an idea of sort of the scope of the record that was involved over the course of, you know, about, it's, you know, 10 years or so that this went on. There were tens of thousands of pages of medical records, obviously, for all of the six children that were involved. More than 70 different expert reports were filed. There was testimony that lasted for about a month. That was divided between a couple of different sessions of two-week periods, over 30 expert witnesses, more than 2,000 pieces of medical literature involving you know, a variety of different expertises and, you know, basic science stuff and all of that, from textbooks to journal articles and all of that. And I say all that just to say that, you know, this was not some sort of fly-by-night, you know, decision. This was somebody's life for an extended period of time. Just the amount of work involved. This is not something that you could have ever had in a civil case. It's too much. There's too many experts. There's too much involved. And the way that they were able to do all that, because of the flexibility that's afforded by having this special program. And basically, you know, this was sort of a take your best shot. And they really did take the best shot they possibly could. And it wasn't close. It wasn't close. Not even the evidence, the judges all, the special masters all agreed that the evidence was overwhelmingly against the petitioner's theories. And so, of course, losing in on that scale with that opportunity left people who believed in the sort of vaccine-caused autism hypothesis, that left them with a bad taste in the mouths.
I can imagine.
Yeah. And so, I mean, you got to think that if they had won, or if even some of them had won, that their view on the vaccine court would have been quite a bit different.
Oh, yeah. Oh, good. Yeah, can you imagine? Yeah. Hey, the U.S. government admits that this is the case. Yeah. Oh, speaking of which, so before I mentioned a case that you wanted to talk about, what one was that?
Oh, yes. So this was a particular case that was originally part of the vaccine injury program, or the omnibus autism proceeding. And this was the case of a girl who had received a vaccine, and she was originally part of the second theory, the idea that the thimerosal-containing vaccines caused her autism. This has been, you know, broadcast quite a bit, including by, you know, her parents. So I feel fine saying that this is the Hannah Poling case, and it's something that gets, you know, trotted out a lot. And what happened was the government essentially conceded her case. And what happens in the vaccine injury program is that if the government agrees that a vaccine caused a particular injury, they can concede that point, and then all they're going to talk about is how much compensation is required. They're not going to have a hearing on the causation portion. And there was an idea that she may have been a candidate for being one of the test cases in that second theory. And the conspiracy theory goes that the government strategically conceded her case because it was so clear that the vaccine had caused her injury, that they didn't want her case to be part of the autism omnibus proceeding. In reality, that is not what happened. Her case was very different from all of the other cases. We know now because of reports that have been should not have been made public, but were, that her particular sort of the way the vaccine may have caused her injury was that she suffered from a mitochondrial disorder, and the very high fever that was the result of that you know the vaccine caused, as it does it sometimes, had an effect on an underlying mitochondrial condition. There's some debate about that because she was not particularly healthy. She'd suffered from quite a few infections, and it's possible that any of her infections could have triggered this. But again, going back to that standard of proof, it's not scientific certainty. It's just more likely than not. And the government felt that in her case, it was particularly, it was probably more likely than not that the vaccine or the fever that was caused by the vaccine was what triggered this problem.
It certainly should be in these cases, if it's, I mean, if it's a case of medical treatment and lifestyles being severely affected, it should be on the it shouldn't be on scientific rigorous scale saying, oh yes, this vaccine is the definite cause of this, we can prove it with this graph, this here, here, here. It should be a lenient say, look, there is a probable cause here, there is a system set up to account for this, it should be used. That doesn't then translate in a court has ruled this,
right,
means that this thing definitely happens. It means there's enough evidence to make a informed decision to say we should release the funds to help this person on the off chance they were hurt.
Yeah, absolutely. And this case again was not a good would not have been a good test case because there was a clear physiological, you know, reaction here, which is not the same as what we're normally talking about when we say what caused autism. The way I like to think about it is if, for example, you have a child that, God forbid, were to fall off a porch and suffer a head injury and then begin to show some of the symptoms, you know, the symptoms that are associated with autism spectrum disorder, would we say that falling off the porch causes autism? In this particular case, you know, that might be more or less accurate, but that's not really what we mean when we say that we're looking for the cause of autism, because that explanation doesn't have a lot of explanatory power for the rest of the cases. And that's the same thing that we have here. Hannah Poling's condition was already extraordinarily rare. Her particular variation of mitochondrial disorder has an incidence, I think, of about 6 in 100,000. This is an extraordinarily rare incident. And again, it goes back to saying that, let's say we knew all this ahead of time, does that mean she shouldn't have gotten the vaccine? I would say no, because first of all, there was still a chance that she could have had the same reaction from getting the infection itself.
Yeah. It's this is where medical sort of ethics becomes really tricky, because yeah. It's like, well, we don't know what the risk is because it's a rare condition. There isn't great evidence on it. We do know what the risks are if we avoid doing it. There's no real way to make a great decision here without, yeah.
Right. But and then also from risk. An ethical perspective, if we do something actively, is that somehow different from, you know, taking the same risk passively? You know, it's difficult. It's a difficult issue. But the reason I bring it up is because a lot of times sometimes you'll see when discussing this case is that, oh well, you know, now we know the government has told us what the, you know, how vaccines cause autism, that it activates an underlying mitochondrial disorder. But again, like you were talking about with encephalopathy, is that, you know, if that were the case, we wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't be a mystery as to why there are so many cases of autism. We would know.
Yeah. It's when concordance comes on. Yeah. We know predictors of what will cause autism, we don't know what the underlying cause is. It's not parasites, it's not thimerosal, it's not, I don't know, GMO food.
Right.
We know what it isn't.
You know, it's worth pointing out that when the government is going to, or HHS, I should say, is going to dispute whether a vaccine caused a particular injury, according to the statute, they're not allowed to rely on, you know, some sort of idiopathic cause. They can't just come in and say, oh, you know, we don't know what caused this reaction, but we know it wasn't this. Like, that's not a legitimate argument for the government to make in a courtroom proceeding, although it is in a scientific, you know, in the scientific world.
Yeah, yeah. And again, if people understand this, I'm perfectly happy with that system. If people understand that a court saying this person was damaged by this vaccine and we're going to award the money, that's very different from someone publishing a study saying, here's evidence that this vaccine causes that.
But people won't look into it that far, though, will they? I mean, do you remember the cases in was it Italy?
Italy, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, where they won.
Yeah, they won, yeah. But and again, I am far more comfortable with the idea that some cases which there wasn't a link, but there is a child or a person who is injured or needs drastic medical help that wasn't caused by a vaccine, I'm happier for them on those occasions to get money than to restrict money when actually there's been an incredibly unfortunate, incredibly unlucky circumstance and someone has been injured by a vaccine.
Yeah, and there, you know, there's with all tort reform, especially this, there, you know, it's not to say that it's a perfect system, and you can definitely say that, especially recently, as we know more and more about causation and about how vaccines actually work in the body, there's been a trend towards the Department of Health and Human Services sort of fighting a little bit harder on the causation, which is leading to fewer rewards. And you know, there's a legitimate argument to be made whether or not that should be is the correct policy. But again, those are legitimate arguments to have, and it's nothing to do with, you know, the court coming out and saying vaccines cause autism. You know, they're totally separate issues that people can disagree about.
Do you think the courts could do more though to put forward what they're in America to put forward what actually they do? Because they seem to be. Because a lot of the time when I see people arguing against vaccines, quite a lot of times, they don't go down the scientific route. They go down the law route. And so, like, they always bring up the cases in Italy, which, by the way, didn't some scientists get done for not predicting earthquakes at the same time? Yeah. Do you think maybe they could do more and be like, listen, this is what we do... you know, this isn't the same as X, Y, and Z, or is that just me who thinks that?
No, I think you're right. I think, you know, more publicity about what the court does and how it makes its decisions and what those decisions really mean, I think a lot more could be done in that area. It's kind of difficult because it's not clear, you know, whether the court is definitely the best person to be able to do that. Because again, these aren't scientists. These aren't people, these are lawyers. And so maybe there should be some more involvement with either CDC or Department of Health and Human Services, FDA. You know, maybe there should be, you know, some sort of involvement there to help explain. Oh,
that's the thing. Have they ever actually came in on one of these procedures and been just like, no, that's wrong. This person, you know, is wrong here.
Yeah, you mean one of the other agencies?
So they've actually came in and been like, "Actually, we think you're wrong with this decision."
I'm sorry, I'm not following.
So has like the CDC come in and overridden?
Oh, I see. You know what? That's something I don't know. I'm not sure. CDC.
I can't imagine it has. If it has happened, it'd be another thing I would have seen. Yeah. The conspiracy side of thing.
It's possible. Yeah, it's quite possible that if that were to have happened, then yeah. Yeah,
but I mean they're different federal agents, so it should, you know, there'd be a standoff going on there where it'd get kicked up another step.
Yeah. There would, and they, you know, the court of federal claims operates fairly independently from the other branches of government because the other branches are often defendants in front of the court of federal claims. So
checks and balances,
exactly.
So there was one last case you wanted to bring up as well.
Yeah, exactly. And it's it's a case that comes up. This isn't actually an autism case, but remember when I said earlier that there was one exception to when you could go to court to sue a manufacturer? There is a provision in the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, the act that brought that around, and it contains this language. I'm just going to read it word for word because it becomes important. And that says, no vaccine manufacturer shall be held liable in a civil action for damages arising from a vaccine injury if the vaccine injury resulted from side effects that were unavoidable, even though the vaccine was properly prepared and accompanied by proper directions and warnings.
Okay, wait. So what does that mean exactly? So unavoidable.
This goes back to, there's in American products liability law, there's basically three different products liability theories that you can advance. One is that you have to show, remember when I was saying when you go to a civil court, you have to show that somebody made a mistake along the way. You've got to show that the product was somehow defective. The first one is you can show that there was a defect in the manufacturing process. This would be like, for example, if this had been around back when, which was it? There was a issue where a vaccine was it one of the early polio vaccine was contaminated in the process.
There was SV40 cells or something in the vaccine early lines.
So if this kind of cause of action had been around at that time, this would have been a manufacturing defect claim. Something went wrong in the manufacture. The other one is that there was a defective warnings. Essentially, you didn't provide sufficient warnings for how the product was to be used and who it wasn't supposed to be used to, and side effects and such. And the third one is what they call design defect. And that is that the product in its design is already dangerous, or it could have been made more safe at a limited, without increasing costs too much and without limiting the efficacy of the product too much. So those are your three classic products liability claims. The question in the case that we're going to talk about, in the case is Brusewitz, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Brusewitz versus Wythe. The question was, does this eliminate design defect claims for vaccine manufacturers? And the result of Brusewitz v. Wythe says, yes, it does. And that's what this is getting after. That's if you've properly prepared it, and if you've given the correct warnings, then you can't be sued because the design was somehow defective.
But wait, wouldn't that discount everything, though? Because if you know that giving vaccines to a population, a tiny fraction of them will have negative effects, and we know those negative effects, can you then throw everything out of court?
So first of all, this is in the civil action, so somebody could still get compensated in the vaccine program, even if they couldn't in a civil action. But the answer is yes. You don't have a claim that the vaccine could have been made safer if it was properly done. Now, so that's why this case had people interested on both sides that weren't anti-vaxxers or weren't crazy people, right? I mean, there's a legitimate argument to say, well, maybe we should still have design defect claims. However, the idea behind it is that if you have a highly regulated market like you've got with vaccines, and you've got, such extensive oversight from the FDA, and you've got experts who are telling you ways that you're supposed to make your vaccines, if you follow their directions and you do it correctly, then the court and the public shouldn't be using the courts to say, oh no, you should have done it a different way, especially when it's really hard to say that. I mean, when we're dealing with either a pathogen or a biological thing, it's really hard to say that if you had done it a different way that necessarily would have been safer. Maybe it would have had, maybe it would have affected a different portion of the population, but it not necessarily would have been safe. I mean, these are all very difficult questions. And the idea is, do we want these questions being hashed out in the court in front of non-experts, or do we want them being hashed out, administratively through the oversight process?
Could you use it for different things, though? Like, going back to my pacemaker I'm going to pacemaker, okay. Sorry. But I mean, like, my thing. So if they said, like, pacemakers, they're known to fail out of every 100,000, could the person who had a failed pacemaker, could they sue the pacemaker manufacturer? Yeah. Would that be alright?
I don't know of any reason why they couldn't. Yeah, so vaccines are treated fundamentally differently from other medical products. Yeah.
But why, though? Why is that okay? I'm actually, the more I'm thinking about this, the more I'm not okay with that.
These are policy decisions that there are good arguments on both sides of why tort reform has, you know, there are problems when you do go to a system like this. This particular design defect one, the way you'll often get it hear it get hashed out is that the United States Supreme Court has declared vaccines unavoidably unsafe. That's the sort of thing that you hear from this. And again, if you go back to the language, it said that the side effects were unavoidable. It didn't necessarily say unavoidably unsafe. Actually, that language, because I assume the people doing it didn't you know, read the case quite as carefully, that language actually comes from the dissent, the opposite. They were arguing that you should be allowed to bring design defect claims, but if the manufacturer can show that the design was as safe as it could possibly be, and yet it would still cause certain injuries, then those are the lawsuits that were being eliminated. Not all design defect claims, but design defect claims for vaccines that could not be made any safer.
So if everything's on equal efficacy levels, yes, you want your vaccine should be as safe as possible. If it's a case of, let's say thimerosal causes MMR in causes autism in 1 in 100 people. If taking that out then reduces the efficacy of that vaccine to a point where 6 people die extra year, out of those 100, what is the payoff there? You have to as a legislator say, yeah, as you said, does this get resolved in court or does it get resolved in framework?
Right.
And with biological stuff, and Miles wouldn't understand the biology side of things, you know. He's too busy just thinking about chemicals and making some IPAC standard chemicals. Yeah, carrying on with that.
Oh, don't get me onto the whole hierarchy again, buddy. I can be a biologist, you can't go up.
I already am a chemist. Everything I do is chemistry, as you said, so I'm way above you.
What? I don't want to get into this. We'll have our quarrel off air.
One day. But yeah, no, it's like... It is something that people should think about, removing this design thing. But
yeah,
in some ways, I do agree with this whole, you know, the Supreme Court said vaccines are unavoidably unsafe. It's true; they're medical interventions.
Well, so just to maybe put a finer point on it, the unavoidably unsafe language comes from another document, which is called the Restatement of Torts. Essentially, you know, in the UK and in the United States and other common law countries, our tort law developed over time through cases being decided. Yeah. This led to people, experts, writing what they call restatements that essentially try to put down in a sort of statutory form what the case law was saying. One of the comments to the case law, and here I've got that here, in the restatement says that there are some products which, in the present state of human knowledge, are incapable of being made safe for their intended and ordinary use. And then it gives an example of the rabies vaccine, is that in order for it to be effective, you know, it carries a significant risk, right? And at the moment, we don't have any way of making it safer. And then it says the same is true of other drugs and vaccines, which is why we have physicians, why we have, you know, oversight and such. So this is part of the restatement. What the court was saying is that's not what they're talking about in the statute. They're not trying to say that vaccines are unavoidably unsafe. What they're saying is that the way that we're going to decide how we improve the designs is not through strategic litigation. And it wasn't the court deciding that. It was the court saying that was Congress's decision. And so it's one of those things that, you know, you could change through the political process. It's not necessarily a court decision. But it's just, it's one of those things that gets thrown around all the time, and it's completely wrong. I mean, maybe factually it's wrong, but that's not what the court was saying. And again, going back to what we were talking about before, even if the court had said all vaccines are unavoidably unsafe, that's a court talking, you know? It's not a science.
Like all diseases are unavoidably unsafe. It's,
right.
It, the reason we have them is because they work and they reduce people dying.
And the benefit, like the risks of intervening are smaller than the risks of not intervening, which is what it all comes down to, essentially.
But no, that is interesting though. I mean, that use of wording and everything, I can understand why some people will take that and run with it. But yeah, that's an interesting one. What do you think, James?
Interesting. We're just having a conversation.
It's one of those things that when people say, you know, vaccine manufacturers have been given complete protection from all liability for everything. No, that's not really the case. One particular thing that is true, though, and that is design defects.
Like going back to that Rob Schneider video, there's so many myths, like half-truths and lies in that. They sort of say, oh, it's the taxpayer's money who pays this. It's like, no, it comes from a 75 cents tax collect on every vaccine sold and bought. It goes into a public pot, but that doesn't mean it's your tax money. And you can sue a vaccine manufacturer. They are exempt from, as you said, the design fault.
One particular area.
If there's a possible way to make it safer, that.
By the way, can we mention how fantastic it is that we live in a world where people are getting medical advice from Rob Schneider? Rob Schneider was a really unfunny comedian, and then one day he realized the vaccines caused autism. They were autism gods. Mm-hmm. I love Sarah Paltrow.
Yeah, it's true. Go ahead, sorry.
This episode's lived up to my expectations of being, if people understood what actually was involved and what was going on and actually how the system was set up, instead of buying this bullshit from people who either trying to sell you something or profit or fear, I think people would look at this and go, yeah, that is a fair system based off the risk of not having a vaccinated population, the fact that the biological systems are messy, and you making something safer might detract from its efficacy. You can't have a public sector producing vaccines without some sort of protection if they're going to get sued in the public system. Because and if it's a public health thing, you want to have these things made. And unless the government's going to start making vaccines, which would just blow conspiracy theorists' minds if they start issuing vaccines, it's not a perfect system. No law system is, and again, a court saying something doesn't make it true. It's preponderance of evidence. It's not scientific fact.
Definitely, again, you know, reasonable people can differ over whether this is the right way to go about it. But that doesn't mean that it's part of a conspiracy to, you know, to hide the truth about vaccines. You know, that's. Yeah.
That's exactly what someone would say who wants to hide the conspiracy, Travis. I'm on to you, buddy.
That's probably true.
Cool. Anyway, chaps, should we call this one to an end? Because we've been chatting for a fair bit of time now. So I just want to say, Travis, hey, man, you know, thanks for coming on. I know it's been, apparently over a year we've been trying to get you on. And it's been really good talking to you. I have to say, I've really enjoyed it. Like, I didn't know that much about the vaccine court. I did a bit of reading and stuff, but yeah, like I've really enjoyed tonight.
Yeah, thanks, same buddy. Here. Thank you so much. I've been following you guys since you started the podcast, and it's really great. Yeah. I'm glad that so I'm no scientist and I'm no skeptic. So it's nice that there's some topic that I can maybe shed some light on. So I hope it was helpful.
I can't believe you've been following us since the beginning and you're still listening. Good God, we must have bored the crap out of you by now. So are you on Twitter or anything? Do you want people to send you hate via Twitter or anything?
No, because if you do, we can plug you. I want all the hate mail to go directly to you.
That's fine. Oh, don't worry. I'm used to it now.
Very kind of you. To everyone out there, Miles really likes it when his watch yells at him, yells nasty things at him.
It's true.
So feel free.
I turned off the YouTube thing, you know.
Have you still got Twitter? Have you still got Twitter on it?
I've still got Twitter, so Buck
sends me... Just tweet him the words furry, people.
Don't know.
Just in all caps. Podcast. All cat locks.
I tell you what, right? You know what's awful? So I was in Belfast last weekend with Buck, and we met up with one of our subscribers for
I wasn't invited, by the way, audience members.
Anyway, so we all sit down, and this guy slightly starts ripping on me from the whole furry thing. I was like, oh, for fuck's sake. By the way, I'm totally not, you know, if you're a furry, that's cool, if that's your own thing, but I'm, where did this even start from, by the way?
You know where.
You know where.
You know where. I'm just going to say one word to you.
Was it Cabot? Yeah. Is it a YouTuber I follow? He's quite funny. That's it. Like, yeah, everyone likes their weird things. And Buck showed me some weird things when I saw him.
I can imagine that a bit better.
Yeah. Apparently there's... Did you know... All right, before we go, I need to talk about this, because I know it's totally off topic, but it's a bit weird. Do you know what the main demographic is on YouTube? James, would you have a guess?
It's going to be something like beauty videos or...
No, like a demographic of people.
Oh, 12-year-olds? I don't know.
Yeah, it's kids. Yeah, like, yeah. Very, very young kids watch a lot of YouTube. And there's this whole subgenre of superheroes getting pregnant that's a thing. Yeah, and Buck showed me it. And you know where you watch something, you're like, what? And these things have like 10 million views. And this is what kids watch. A lot of this. Weird. Yeah, and so suddenly my Cabot watching doesn't seem so bad now. Anyway, on that note, I'm probably going to... Yeah, we should probably call this podcast to an end. So, Travis, once again, thanks, buddy, for coming on.
Yeah, it's
been really good talking to you.
Thanks so much.
Cool. So, yeah, if you like this podcast, remember to give us a like on the old YouTube. And if you like us a lot, give us a review on the old iTunes. What do I normally say? Oh, yeah, remember, we still got the competition going. So if you get Alex Jones to mention your crazy conspiracy, I will fly James out with you with some scented bath oils or what have you, and he'll give you the sexiest of back rubs, I hear. So, yeah, that's still going.
Sexiest might be a bit strong.
We'll put a little asterisk inside of it. Yeah, anyway. So, yeah, all right then. So it's goodbye from me, Miles. Goodbye, Internet. It's goodbye from James.
Goodbye, everyone.
And it's goodbye from Travis.
Take care, everyone.